Hey, everybody. First off, I hope you're safe and healthy and well and all that good stuff in the midst of our miraculous times. This is Dr. Smith, and this is a brief introduction to the work of Immanuel Kant within the context specifically of kind of what's interesting about him politically. He's one of the great philosophers of all time. And this is, of course, for PolySci 1040/4020. So just to give us a sense of who Kant is before we just dive into things. First off, born in Königsberg, what was then Prussia, now it's Kaliningrad, Russia, in 1724. He'll attend the University of Königsberg, where he leaves for a time. In 1746, becomes a tutor for a while, returns to the university in 1754 as a private docent. And again, pronunciation, don't beat me up, I don't speak German. Which is specifically a kind of professor, though, who is paid privately by students. And apparently he's pretty popular, he's a good lecturer, and he did a lot of lectures. Apparently would do up to 20 in a week, which is kind of crazy, actually. I wonder how long they were and so forth. But eventually, his reputation is built high enough, in no small part because he actually wrote two dissertations, that he becomes the professor of logic and metaphysics at Königsberg, at the University of Königsberg. And he's going to write a whole host of different really important books. I'm not going to go over every book and essay because that would take an age. Some of the ones you might be interested in, 1781, he writes The Critique of Pure Reason, which is a response to Hume's approach to basically his theory of knowledge. In the 1780s, actually, he'll spend most of the time writing different essays and works that are basically kind of lumped together as the critiques. And they are a series of different works intended to be basically critiques of different kinds of approaches to knowledge and epistemology and all that good stuff. And those lead to him beginning to write more about ethics, which and naturally also leads to him writing about politics. Maybe not naturally. It seems natural to me, but I'm a political philosopher. The essay that is most important, I think, in modern political thought, I'm sure some would disagree with me. He's going to publish in 1795. It's called Towards Perpetual Peace, or Perpetual Peace, a Philosophical Study, depending on who you read and take into account in that. He also writes and publishes in 1797 Metaphysics of Morals, 1798 An Anthropology from a Pragmatic Point of View. He dies ultimately in 1804 after 4 years of kind of gradually slipping into dementia. And his students take care of him because he never gets married, never has kids. He's a very interesting man. He was very, very popular. They had a giant funeral for him in Königsberg. And he seems to be he's a very interesting man because if you read his stuff, he definitely kind of spans that late Enlightenment phase of thought, in which he's deeply influenced by kind of like traditional Enlightenment thinkers, but like it also in particular Rousseau, right, who in many ways is like the anti-Enlightenment thinker. In fact, I've read some sources that say the only decoration he allowed in his house, the only ornament, was a portrait of Rousseau. And the only time he actually forgot to take his daily walk, was when he was reading a book by Rousseau. Now, those seem kind of unlikely to me, both of them, but they make for great stories. So, just to give you a sense of some of the things I went to for my research, two things in particular kind of ended up being really useful for me, in case you're curious and you want to look up further stuff. One is Tim Jankowiak, I hope I'm saying that right, Tim Jankowiak, who is a professor at Towson University, wrote an article on Kant for the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy that's just hot dog great. I also read well, over the years I've read most of Kant's, what we would call, regard as his like political essays and political writings. There's a really good collection of those in the Cambridge Text of History of Political Thought, called Kant Political Writings. What a surprise. Very innovative. Edited by H.E. Rice, spelled R-E-I-S-S, which has an excellent introduction to a lot of the fundamental concepts of Kantian thought, and does a really good job, actually, of putting those into a historical context. So that's a great resource, too, if you're looking for further information. All that said, and we could say a whole host more, obviously, we can't talk about every single thing that Kant was interested in. It just would take a really long time and lead us down any number of rabbit holes that would get us off the subject of what we might think of as properly political philosophy and theory. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on things that I think are really critical to putting Kant's work into the broader context, and then I'm going to really focus on a couple key political points, especially the work of the Essay on Perpetual Peace. So first off, it's important to bear in mind that Kant is someone who is, in essence, he's a transcendental theorist. What does that really mean? Well, as a transcendental idealist, what does that really mean? Well, ultimately, what it means is that he distances himself from people who argue that what we are sensing is the objective truth. He argues that there is a truth that is absolute, that is absolutely sensible, and is therefore what we might regard as knowable objective truth, observable objective truth, what have you. And then there are truths which we cannot, which may be true, which may be objectively true, but we cannot sense those truths. We can only attempt to know them through other means. But those are, again, attempt is really the right word. We cannot sense them, we cannot perceive them, we cannot measure them, and so therefore we cannot class them as truly knowable. And that includes everything from, you know, concepts like God and soul and so such have you. And this is not to say that those things like God and soul do not exist, but it means that we cannot regard them in the same way. We can't hold them or analyze them in what we would think of as scientific terms. So that's, I mean, for us, that's kind of one of the key things. A good way to think of it is this. There is a distinction between what things are and how they appear. That's really critical as well. Maybe not the only thing we need to know, but like that's a big part of it. So when we perceive the world as, let's say I see an orange. My understanding of that orange, the things I perceive, the weight, the smell, the shape, the texture, all of that stuff, right? That is quite distinct from what the orange is. My sensory input is not the same. Now, that doesn't mean my sensory input is wrong, necessarily, but it is distinctive. Another key kind of part of his transcendental theory, right, is that space and time can be understood as both a priori, that is to say, before the fact. We could just regard them as they're there, but also as subjective. In other words, we perceive them quite differently. We simply perceive space and time according to our reference points. And that's just the nature of the beast. That kind of fits in, I think, quite well with our earlier statement. Also, we can say that we have determinate cognition of only those things experienced. So what does that really mean? That's a real fancy way of putting it. Ultimately, it means that we can say we know only those, the appearance of things. We can only say we know what they seem to be definitively. So there's basically, I mean, for us, that really comes down to a we're limited in terms of how we can functionally conceptualize truth, what we can know about the world. All right, so that's one little starting point. Nothing fancy there. What else can we talk about? Well, Mr. Kant kind of builds his ethical theory around a concept known as the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative, in broad strokes, we can understand it as saying that all people should respect one another and all rules should hold the same for everyone. That's kind of the broad strokes of it. There's two different articulations of this, so I'll give you both. The first, like, formulation is act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it would become a universal law. And the second formulation is, I got that written right here, so act that you use humanity, whether in your own person or in any other, always at the same time as an end, never merely as a means. So let's break down what this means. Let's kind of take this apart. So the first formulation is basically telling us that if we want to understand what constitutes a moral rule, a rule of action that should be in place, determining what we should and should not do, we can understand that rule as being morally necessary within the context of it being, is it something that we can reasonably, and this is really critical, that we can use our using our reason, we can argue that it should be applied equally to everyone, including ourselves, right? That there's no reasonable exception to that rule. If it can't be applied reasonably to everyone, it shouldn't be a moral rule. Fair enough. I makes a lot of sense, and we'll see when we get to, if you take 40-60, we talk about John Rawls, actually, he's gonna build on this concept some. The other kind of formulation here, right? The second formulation being, so act that you use humanity, whether in your own person or in any other, always at the same time as an end, never merely as a means. Human beings are not just means. We are the ends as well as sometimes means. But if our decisions, if our behaviors, if our choices are to be rational, then we have to engage in humaneness. We have to be humane. We have to, and Confucian thought actually has a concurrent concept of humanity, of Ren. We have to be thinking about other human beings as both, basically, not just other human beings, but ourselves as the end, as the purpose. The reason for an action, the reason for a rule, must be that it is somehow for human beings. And we cannot merely ethically objectify other human beings. We cannot turn other human beings merely into tools or devices. Now, you may remember, with Hobbes, there's a hint of this, right? Hobbes distinguishes between the power of instruments, that is to say, of things or object, things being tools, basically, and the power that that gives to human beings, and then political power, which is the power of that is derived from groups of human beings choosing to cooperate within a civil arrangement. Ultimately, that's kind of the nitty-gritty here, right? Like, when we look at this, what we're seeing is that Kant is arguing that those two conditions can exist, and the one is just, that is to say, one in which we regard the state and our moral rules and anything else exists for people, and then there's the alternative view where the people exist for for me. And anytime we just we merely determine that people are tools, we objectify them, we turn them into, in essence, slaves or some other kind of just something we're using, that's immoral. That's unacceptable. So that's the categorical imperative in broad strokes, the lickety-split version. He also would argue at different points that ethics require that we believe in free will. Whether or not, now we can't prove that free will exists, right? I can't, using my senses, be 100% certain that free will exists. But it is critical that I believe that free will exists if I want to be able to believe that ethics are possible, if I want to be ethical. If I believe that human beings' choices hinge upon reason, then I have to believe that an ethical human is someone who chooses to be reasonable, and an unethical human is someone who chooses to be unreasonable, to deny reason. This is kind of sounding a little Lockean too, right? And ultimately, what that means is, imagine we remove free will from that equation, right? Can you speak to human beings legitimately, meaningfully having any control over their destiny? And the answer is no. Well, if they don't have control over their destiny, if they don't have control over their choices, then there is no ethics. Like a fungus doesn't have to be concerned with ethics, because a fungus merely acts according to the way its genetic material tells it to act. It is simply reacting to the environment it finds itself in. That means it is not consciously making choices. Because and so therefore, having no free will, it is not having to deal with anything we would regard as ethics. Humans having free will, not being merely reactive, do have to deal with ethics and have to deal with the ethical consequences of our decisions. He also points out that moral law is derived from our rationality, which again sounds like Locke, right? But what's really fascinating about this is moral law, therefore, is imposed on ourselves. In other words, he recognizes a sort of natural volition. Human beings, being reasonable, perceive moral law, and then we impose it on ourselves. So that's a little different from Locke, right? Locke kind of argues that moral law is built into the universe so that by God, right, in the creation and the manifestation of the universe, and then when human beings then look at the universe, we're like, oh, here it is, hot dog, and we're reasonable, we then perceive the moral logic built in the universe. The creator has left it there for us. In essence, Kant's leaving it a little different. He's saying that we perceive the moral law, but the law, it doesn't really matter why it's reasonable for Kant. It's not necessarily that God did or didn't put it in there. It's that we then go, oh, well, it's here, so we impose it on ourselves because we're just reasonable beings. The only unconditional good is goodwill, he points out. I think that's really interesting. So when we think about like Machiavelli and Hobbes and other realists, they're very, very clear about the fact that they would argue that it's some variation of the ends justify the means. In other words, the ethical quality of a policy is dependent upon the outcome of the policy. What Kant is saying is, no, the ethical quality of a policy ultimately is kind of, we can gauge it in two different ways. We can understand the ethical quality in terms of its intent. If the intent is genuine goodwill, if it meets the rules of the categorical imperative, then that is something we can regard as a genuine, truly distinct goodwill. Like it is a genuinely ethical, maximally ethical thing. We can never, however, regard an actual application of human will as perfectly good. It will always be an imperfect attempt to achieve in an imperfect world the good in practice. So it is not unconditional good. It is a conditional good, which I guess you just dropped it on. So that's an interesting kind of a variation and development. We can also look at our friend Mr. Kant, and there's a really interesting article he writes called The Idea for a Universal History with a Cosmopolitan Purpose. Now, it is very interesting that he is specifically aiming at cosmopolitanism. He's interested in humans, he's interested in individuals, and he's not merely interested in states. So he's not merely a nationalist, but then again, he's also deeply influenced by, you know, the moment he's in. He wouldn't be a Rousseau fan if he didn't have any sympathy for nationalism. So what we see here is in this idea for universal history, he lays out a couple basic propositions that are kind of neat. One is that the natural purpose of humanity is the development of reason. Now, this kind of makes sense. It's nothing too radical, right? We're human beings. We are the reasoning creatures. So the idea that, like, we have this, what distinguishes us is going to be our reason. Okay, no big deal. And if you're looking for then a theory of history, that is to say some sort of way of modeling what is the best way to understand human progress, or I suppose retrogression if you are of that mind, or even cyclic progression, then that makes sense that you're going to say, well, it's human reason that is the thing that is most distinctly human, and therefore we can understand the purpose of humanity, the natural demarcation of human history as being one of gradual, steady improvement and development of our skills in reasoning. And critical to this, however, is this dilemma that we're in. The dilemma is, are we actually progressing? Are we retrogressing, right? Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? Or are we like kind of just stuck in this unchanging, lumpy morass in which we literally are just, it's completely static. There's no real dynamism. And this is a quandary that he's got to deal with. Well, ultimately, our friend Mr. Kant is going to say, the way we can kind of understand this is by conceiving of humans as unsocial social creatures, or we exist as creatures of unsocial sociability. In other words, there's a natural tension in human beings. We are naturally social beings. We desperately need to cooperate to survive. We're not particularly strong, fast, agile, nimble. We don't have armor. We don't have big claws. We are not the equivalent of so many species in the world that can survive quite by themselves just fine. Thank you very much. Nor are we, on the other hand, prone to easily get along with each other. We're certainly not like animals that have no concept of hierarchy at all, but even comparative to other hierarchical animals, the complexity of our machinations and our competition for limited resources and goods is shocking, right? We are prone to egoism. We are prone to factionalism. And so we have this built-in darn contradiction, and it's difficult to resolve. And in the process of that, that kind of explains part of the difficulty of mapping our progress in terms of our natural progression of reason. But it also helps us to understand what is the goal. And the reason it does is if we want to know what the goal is, the end point, the ultimate kind of the end of history moment, well, then that end of history would be a point in which we are able to achieve a nature, a kind of a natural condition in which we automatically interact with each other based upon points of reason, based upon the imperative, right? The conditional imperative. The categorical imperative. I apologize, guys. By doing so, when we reach this point, then the fundamental struggle of the unsocial versus the social gets resolved. We're able to disagree, but still agree on all of the points that are necessary to allow us to cooperate existentially, right? And that means that we're going to end up with the best possible quality of life. We ultimately will enter a new condition, kind of. Now, if you were to look ahead, I mean, this is going to influence guys like Hegel and Marx and all sorts of things. And it's well trod turf, frankly, in my opinion, in the Western world. The idea that history has a purpose, we should be able to resolve what it is, and there's an end point. I mean, it's even going to influence guys like Francis Fukuyama towards the end of the 20th century. I'm also profoundly skeptical of anyone who claims that history has rules. But that doesn't mean it doesn't influence the way people think, and so it's worth talking about. Now, here's the thing. Why does this matter to us, especially if Dr. Smith is skeptical of the utility of all this good stuff? Well, because of the fact that he's going to argue that this requires us to create both perfectly just states, perfectly just societies, which are governed by reason, which are governed by the categorical imperative, which are what he conceives of as republics. So these perfectly just states. And then on the other hand, we have to have a condition of interstate peace. In other words, a condition in which international war has basically completely disappeared and therefore allows human beings at every kind of level of the political game to trust in reason and cooperation and equity rather than anything else, rather than having to be merely egoistic or factionalistic. Okay, now just to add a little bit more richness to this, if we want to understand kind of what makes this reasonable, just state possible internally, we can look at basically these three. There are three principles of right that Kant is going to enunciate. One of these principles of right is freedom, right? And literally, what this is for him is a condemnation of utilitarianism. Now, utilitarianism is basically it's a whole group of different philosophical approaches, if we want to take it adequately generic, and I do for this purpose, that basically argues that the purpose of politics is to try to maximize happiness for the maximal number of people. Now, you can interpret that in a bunch of different ways, but basically it means that the purpose of the state and the purpose of law and the purpose of society is to make people happy, and as many people as happy as possible. What Kant says is that's not true. The purpose of the state, the purpose of society, the purpose of reason, and the purpose of law are instead properly better understood as the pursuit of happiness. It is to guarantee that we as individuals have the ability to freely pursue our happiness, to decide what is our happiness, and as long as, again, it doesn't violate that ethical tenet of the categorical imperative, to pursue our own happiness. which should sound familiar. If you're familiar with American history at all, you know, the pursuit of happiness is in there. Now, of course, that's going to be complicated because it also is Ben Franklin's way of dealing with the whole question of property, but it sounds familiar, and that's good enough for me, right? Whatever, we're moving on. So freedom is ultimately one of our key kinds of principal rights. Our second principal right is equality, and this is specifically equality under the law. It's the idea, again, this fits perfectly within our categorical imperative, right? The idea that we should all be equally, all laws should apply to all men equally. Now, if you read his other stuff, he does have some kind of problematic exceptions to this. So, like, he doesn't believe that a sovereign, while they're in office, should be able to be ever, not even while they're in office, but even after an office, like things that they did as part of their job, that is something that they should be able to be criminally liable for. So there are still some exceptions in there, but you know, in broad strokes, our man Kant is saying human equality is equality under the law. That's our second principle right. Our third principle right, then, is ultimately, it's a word that is translated, at least by Rice, as independence. And I find that deeply confusing as an American who doesn't speak German. The, Selbstständigkeit? Anyways, basically, it's easier if I just explain broadly what this is. Basically, it's the idea that every citizen must have a right to participate in government. Now, in other words, we might think of this as the citizen's right to participate actively. Beyond just the law is applied to all of us, so in that fundamental way, all citizens theoretically have a right to be active participants in the state as citizens. In the United States, that typically implies a right to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, but also things like running for office, voting for the representatives, maybe referendums and recalls and stuff like that. It implies the right to serve on juries and so forth. Eligibility for offices of trust. Now, Kant is, again, he's a man of the late 18th century. So he does still distinguish between active citizens and passive citizens. Specifically, only active citizens have a right to vote and legislate. But the active citizens are supposed to pass legislation as if it is also, they're taking into account basically the decisions of passive citizens on they have power delegated from. So you might argue that this is, this is something that we see in Greek thought, we see it in the early United States and in Britain and so forth, where we have rules about who can and can't participate based on property. Obviously, we have the women are forbidden from participating as active citizens pretty much universally for a very long time. But Kant still, in broad strokes, is arguing that there is a basic rule that a basic principle of right that everyone should have access to the state. I find his inability to say that this means everyone should be a citizen in practice, but somehow has a right to be a citizen, as wanting his cake and to eat it too. Maybe this is just merely, on the one hand, it really might just be a political concession. You know, he lives in an authoritarian government. On the other hand, it's intellectually inconsistent, and it's problematic and so forth. I don't know. Who am I? All right. We got that. That is the broad strokes of everything we're going to get to until we get to the perpetual piece, a philosophical sketch. Now, perpetual piece of philosophical sketch is one of the most interesting, most important essays in the history of political philosophy and thought. It came out in, I believe, 1795. let me double check here. Yeah, 1795. And it's actually not very long. Basically the idea is that Kant is trying to define what are the prerequisites to a permanent, durable, practical, perpetual peace, a condition in which war between nation states, or let's maybe call them nation states, let's not get that fancy, states largely disappears. What are the conditions that are going to be necessary for that to happen? And he divides up his preconditions into preliminary articles, which are truly preconditions and are like think of them as the foundation. And then the principal pillars, which are the definitive articles. So what we're going to do is we're just going to take those step by step and make sure it's clear what each of these preliminary and definitive articles are. And then with each one, we'll kind of talk about to what degree modern international politics has modeled itself on this. And I just want to say, before we move on, this is super duper important. We live, if you ask international relations scholars, we live in what may be the most peaceful time in human history. It's not that there is no interstate war, but it's just rarer than it has been a long time. Now, why? There are a couple big theories. One of the big theories is the United States and her allies are so powerful that these nations are able to enforce a hegemonic peace on everyone else, whether they like it or not. And that's a reasonable hypothesis. Another reasonable hypothesis is we have weapons of mass destruction now. Some of them are really cheap, like chemical weapons. Some require a lot of expertise, like biological and thermonuclear or atomic or whatever kinds of weapons. But either way, it's reasonable to assume every country on Earth could have some type of weapon of mass destruction with delivery capabilities at least of hitting neighbors, right? The United States, Russia, Britain, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, all of these states have active nuclear armament or arsenals. The U.S. alone could destroy all life on the Earth, at least all life bigger than a microbe that isn't hidden somewhere very deep underground or in rifts of the ocean, over and over again. So could the Russians, the British, the French, and the Chinese. Like, we have the ability to, in essence, end life. Certainly end human life in any sense that was remotely worth living. That is to say, other than in some kind of god-awful shelter. And this creates mutually assured destruction, a condition in which if anyone starts a major war, a war like World War I, World War II, the French and Indian War, the Napoleonic Wars, if we have another war of that scale, there's a very real possibility that all life on the planet will die. And as Sting said, the Americans hope that the Russians love their children too. I suppose the Russians hope the same thing about us. The idea that we are afraid to fight anymore for fear it will give us no advantages but only costs. And so therefore we've had to learn to be peaceful. That's another major hypothesis. And I think those are reasonable hypotheses. Another major hypothesis is that we've become more and more capitalist. So the reason we used to fight over relatively rare resources, natural resources, that's basically become less and less important as international systems of trade have become more regularized. Now that's, of course, that works in conjunction with the whole idea that the U.S. and its allies are guaranteeing that international trade. But yeah, that's also reasonable. There's another major kind of idea, which is that human beings create and change. We're constructing new relationships internationally. some of the ways we're doing this is we're changing the way our domestic infrastructure works. And some of the ways we're doing this is we're literally creating new forms of anarchy. So in terms of the domestic, basically the idea is that the way you govern yourself changes the way in which you make decisions and make certain types of decisions more or less likely. That's the super fast version of it. It's basically the opposite of what Thomas Hobbes believed, right? Hobbes believed everyone was egoistic in the state of nature and the war of all against all. So if you had that condition in the pre-state condition, then the international realm is a war of all against all. And so it is one in which all states, no matter what their internal government, are all ultimately just looking out for their own interests. And so therefore, there's no reason to expect any kind of peace ever that's lasting between states in anarchy. What neoliberal theorists are going to argue is that democracies, political systems that are internally democratic, internally republican, internally egalitarian, they behave differently than non-democracies. And that ultimately, one of the first people to really argue for this is going to be Kant, we're going to see. So Kant, part of his argument is going to be that the internal design of a state can be changed in a way that makes peace more likely. The other thing is this constructivist argument, that we can create institutions that are state-like, that are rule-enforcing, that exist to arbitrate, not between individuals, which is what states do, but between states. In other words, we have the ability to create interstate organizations that are, call them whatever you want, call them suprastates, call them IGOs, intergovernmental organizations, call them a host of different things, but that we can construct anarchy. That anarchy isn't something that is natural in the sense that Hobbes seems to indicate, but anarchy is actually something that we can redesign according to human cultural will. And that ultimately is going to be the other area that Kant's going to hang his hat on. So let's dive into this a little bit. Okay. So literally the first preliminary article is simply this. No conclusion of peace shall be considered valid as such if it was made with a secret reservation of the material for a future war. It's all it is. What does that mean is if you plan, if you make a treaty, you cannot put an exception to the treaty in. You cannot design the treaty in such a way that it gives you permission to start a war in the future. This is both a practical concern, literally in the legalistic language of the treaty, but one has to assume that he's also implying that this is a good faith article, right? So we look at World War I and we see that the people are exiting the Treaty of Versailles negotiations. There are people who are basically arguing, yeah, this is a 20-year peace. We're going to fight another war. And it's because we've concluded treaties that are unequal, that are unfair, that are making people ticked off at one another, and that are built in to allow, basically, exceptions to rules. Basically, to allow some groups to justify violence. Now, that was less of a clear exception than we might think of as a legalistic exception, so much as just like kind of a logical exception, but nonetheless, it holds. All right, our second preliminary article. No independently existing state, whether it be large or small, may be acquired by another state by inheritance, exchange, purchase, or gift. Now, what does that mean? Well, very simply, what it means is that all human beings deserve rule of, for, and by the people. And I mean that in the nationalistic sense. Every group of human beings has a right to self-determine. The state does not exist for anyone except the people who rule it. And so when states are divided up or chopped up, either in a kind of feudalistic or traditional pre-modern imperialistic way, the kind that we see defining virtually all of European and African and Asian history, over and over and over, empires rising, falling, gobbling up other peoples, or whether we're talking about specifically the types of empires that we see in the first or second wave of colonialism, the first wave, of course, in the Americas, the second wave in particularly in Asia and Africa, the either of these, what we're seeing is the basis of war, right? People are being made into merely means to power. The state isn't being run for them. This means you're creating not only justifications for violence between the imperial powers, but also you're creating all sorts of justification for violence among the peoples who have been conquered, right? If we look at Africa today and all those lovely straight lines we see often on that continent's maps, what we're seeing is that the boundaries and borders are highly artificial. When they were drawn, they had no interest. The Europeans had no interest, oftentimes, in the people who actually lived there. And the post-colonial states that have emerged are fundamentally unstable in no small part because you have nations which are where you have lots of different people who share interests, who share an identity, who conceive themselves as properly under a single political system, that they're split between one or between two or three or four or five or six different nation states. And this is problematic. The design of a state should be about the people who constitute it. States are not property. They are not dowry. They shouldn't be sold and bought. Every time we do that, we're just creating the basis of future antagonism. Three, the third preliminary article. Standing armies will gradually be abolished altogether. Standing armies are bad. Why? Well, this is actually something that's a general tenet of liberal thought, lowercase l liberal thought. And really what it comes down to is a couple things. One is, if the bigger your standing army, the higher your odds are of an accidental act of violence, what we would call a militarized interstate dispute. You just accidentally end up fighting each other, which can lead to war, right? So that's one reason. Another reason is professional standing militaries, whether they're made up of mercenaries or they're made up of professionals in the vocational sense, they constitute economic factions. And it's very easy, not in every country, but in many instances, for these factions to come to believe that war is useful because it will present them with opportunities for advancement economically, socially, politically, and so forth. And so you have a powerful faction with substantial political influence that has an interest in a war which will not necessarily be in the interest of anyone else in the state. Okay, fair enough. What else is a reason for that? Well, the third big reason is simply this. Militaries are expensive, guys. They're expensive. And anytime you have something that you've paid a lot of money for, it's hard to justify it simply in terms of, I want it because I may need it. If you buy a big fancy golf club set and you take it home and your spouse sees it and it's good, well, okay, that's fine, but then you never use it again. And then like a year later you show up and you have a super expensive fly fishing set, your spouse is going to look at you and say, okay, come on now. Really? Like you keep paying for all these expensive things that you don't use. And so what's your inclination going to be? Well, your inclination is to use it, even if you're only going to do it half-heartedly, not because you want to, but because it's justifying future expenses. And that's something we see in international politics as well, that sometimes militaries are used largely to justify their existence. And that obviously could be a major potential threat. All right, our fourth preliminary. No national debt shall be contracted in connection with the external affairs of the state. In other words, you can't contract national debt with the specific purpose of trying to undermine another state, to give you a justification for going to war with that state. And the proof, in the like, this is a real problem. If you think back to, for instance, the late 19th century, the British and the Germans were notorious for seeking to intentionally drive up the debt that Latin American states had with their banking establishments. And there's a general assumption that this was to gain political influence over those states, possibly with the idea of eventually establishing some of these states, basically depoliticizing them, making them into colonies of Britain or Germany or some other European state. This was such a significant threat that it was part of what prompts Theodore Roosevelt to issue the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which was basically an assertion that debt is not a justification for invading any nation in the Western Hemisphere. And if a nation needs a collections agency, then they have to come through the United States. Now, that part, honestly, frankly, there's no legal justification for it. But nonetheless, what it does do is it diffuses any possibility that the European states will try to recolonize Latin America. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And that's the idea, is that debt can be used as a justification for violence. No state shall, this is the fifth preliminary article, I probably should have said that. No state shall forcibly interfere in the constitution and government of another state. So that's our fifth preliminary article. What does that mean? Well, ultimately what it comes down to is it means that states have to recognize the essential sovereignty of other states. We can see the beginning of this all the way back in the late Middle Ages. The Renaissance and the Reformation and Catholic Counter-Reformation. When the Middle Ages are becoming, if you will, the modern world. Kind of an early version of this, or a proto-version of this, is the emergence of an idea that was an attempt in the Peace of Augsburg from 1555 to try to basically end conflict between Roman Catholics and Protestants with the development of this idea of quius regio eius religio, which we could kind of translate basically, if we want to do it as simply as possible, as whoever rules or whoever's realm it is, their religion is what shall be in place. And that's the long and the short of it, basically. The idea is very simple, that the state, every state has a right to determine its own religion. And therefore, the religion of your peer state is not a justification for interstate warfare. Now, obviously, if you know anything about European history, nobody really lives up to that. I mean, you can argue that every war through World War II has at least some religious dimension. But the idea is emergent that basically the internal constitution, which if we look early enough, does involve things like religiosity, of a state is ultimately the interest of the state. The state and its people have the right to make that determination for themselves. So, why is that the case? Well, gosh, why wouldn't it be? If I try to say I have a right to attack another state because of what that state is doing internally, well, virtually any disagreement then becomes a potential legitimization of interstate violence. That's obviously a big, huge, gigantic problem. All right, speeding along as fast as we can. That leads us to the sixth and final preliminary article. No state at war with another shall permit such acts of hostility as would make mutual confidence impossible during future times of peace. Such acts would include the employment of assassins or poisoners, breach of agreements, the instigation of treason, etc. So, what does this mean? Ultimately, it's a recognition of the emotional insight of Machiavelli. If we look at Machiavelli, he talks enormously and frequently, right, if you remember, about emotion. Well, one of the things he notes is that hate will fundamentally alter the way in which we calculate cost, benefit, and risk and make things viable or justifiable that otherwise we would never be able to justify. All of these things, from poisoning to these, let's call them crimes against humanity or war crimes, all of them are things that can ultimately lead to a condition of hatred, of permanent enmity, which makes war more likely in the future. So, all right, he's got something there. What else we got? Well, this leads us to the second big section of the perpetual peace. And the second big section includes the three definitive articles. There's just three more. So we have the first definitive article: the civil constitution of every state shall be republican. That is to say, founded on three principles: freedom of, here, I'll just read actually directly what he writes actually. Firstly, the principle of freedom for all members of society. Secondly, the principle of the dependence of everyone upon a single common legislation as subjects. And thirdly, the principle of legal equality for everyone as citizens. So ultimately what he's arguing for is, he's got a very broad definition of republic, but one in which there is, everyone gets to participate as citizens, in which the laws are applied under rule of law equally, in which we have individual freedom. Why is this the case? Well, this is going to be the root of something we call the democratic peace thesis, actually, in political philosophy, and or political theory and international relations. Ultimately, it comes down to being in a democracy or a republic or a free state or an egalitarian state. All of these have the effect of changing the way in which you calculate cost, benefit, and risk. If I live in a democracy, for instance, and I'm a leader in a democracy, how did I get my office? What am I good at that allowed me to acquire political position? Well, what I'm good at is cooperation, and I'm good at being clever, at convincing people. I'm good at working with groups, even frequently groups that don't like each other very much. Democracies are all about people who don't get along still managing to make a go at living together, right? And leaders in democracy, therefore, are going to be biased, prejudiced, if you will, towards this perspective in their approach to everything, right? If I'm a little kid with a hammer, I try to solve every problem in the house with that hammer. In the same sense, political leaders, however they acquire and maintain office, are likely to use whatever that strength is in other ways. And we see that's true. Democracies are generally more peaceful, at least in their relations with other democracies. We're not going to get too deep into that because that can lead us down, again, a giant rabbit hole. Also, democracies and republics are made up of people, right? And normal people, schmucks like you and me, people who have jobs, what do we want from our government? Well, we want it to keep us safe. We want it to keep the economy functioning. And we want it to do these two things largely in a way that doesn't overly tax us, that doesn't take too much of our wealth, of our labor, of our time, right? So what we want is to be able to live freely, have a nice life, pursue what we want, and not be put in the poorhouse, and feel safe, like be able to sleep at night. They're not really crazy things. That's quite different than what, say, a king wants, right? A king or an authoritarian ruler probably wants to be immortal, basically. They want to be remembered forever. They've already got honor, wealth, and power. What else can they want? Well, they want the closest thing, since they can't actually live forever and keep having those things and keep acquiring those things forever, they want the closest they can get, and that's to be remembered. How do you get remembered? What's the easiest way to be remembered? Well, you fight people. And so the more authoritative a government is, the more prone to war it is the general assumption. Democracies and republics and democratic republics are generally understood as being less prone to war, basically because of the fact that the normal people who make up the citizenry don't have an interest in wars. Wars don't give them anything. They're expensive, and they become a meat grinder for their kids. That doesn't mean democracies and republics can't fight wars, and it doesn't mean that they don't want to maintain a decent, strong army to defend themselves. But it means they're less likely to engage in the kind of imperialistic antics that lead to high frequencies of war. That's a super short version of why the definitive article might have this effect. Okay, fair enough. The second definitive article is basically this. The right of nations shall be based on a federation of free states. So we're going to come up with a list of reasonable rights that every nation will have, and they will exercise these within a federation of free states. What does that really mean? It means that there's going to be some kind of organization, supra-organization, which creates laws that govern broadly and basically the relationships of those states and guarantee their rights. That, in other words, I'll provide for some sort of enforcement mechanism. Why is this the case? Well, why do I not have to go hunt down the person who stole something from me in the streets? Well, because I can call the cops and I can have people who are trained, who my society has specifically invested with this power, and who has specifically trained and has given specific trust and oversight to. And they do this on my behalf. I only have the right to defend myself in the instant that it's under threat. Otherwise, in order to create a peaceful nation, we have created, in essence, these infrastructure of arbiters. Well, that's what Kant argues we need in the international sphere. Hobbes argued we couldn't have universal peace because there was no universal state. And we can't have a universal state because it's just not possible. It would be too big. What Kant is saying is we don't need a universal state. What we need is a state of all of the states. Again, assuming all those states are republics. Fair enough, makes some sense. All right, then we have the third definitive article, the final definitive article of perpetual peace. The cosmopolitan right shall be limited to conditions of universal hospitality. In other words, there's going to be what we would call universal human rights, but they're going to be limited to things that are the basic hospitalities that any human being should be able to expect if they are an alien interacting with another country. In other words, it's going to deal with things like laws of war and how we manage prisoners of war, how we manage shipwreck victims, what guarantees do we give to people who in good faith engage in international trade, and so forth. So it's not going to be that universal, but bear this in mind. This is within a framework where Kant argues every state is a republic, right? In which every state will be guaranteeing certain freedoms on their own. So he's trying to leave room for variation amongst states, for the Frances to be different than the Britons, to be different than Japan, to be different from the United States. Different enough that you could recognize the difference, but with enough universal guarantees of hospitality that, again, you don't accidentally create justifications for violence through hatred. Okay, so where do we stand on this? Let's look. Do we have any kind of concept that no conclusion of peace shall be considered valid if it was made with a secret reservation? I would argue that those have become far less common since the end of World War II, but that's also to a degree subjective. It's difficult to say how much we could evaluate that as true. But I think since the end of World War II, that's become more common. If for no other reason, the United States clearly doesn't really like them. No independently existing state whether large or small, may be acquired by another nation or another state by inheritance, exchange, purchase, or gift. That has become absolutely the rule of thumb. Since the end of World War II, we've seen, like at the end of World War I, there was a real effort by some nations, including the United States, to make that the rule of thumb. It just didn't work out, clearly. At the end of World War II, the realization was that as wars get bigger and bigger, they're becoming existential threats to our species. And we finally actually started to see the end of this. And what you see is that by the time we reach the 1970s, virtually every colony on the virtually every colony on Earth is an independent country. And what that really means is that we've reached a point where it's reasonable to assume that, yeah, it seems that there's some justice in terms of guaranteeing that states have a right to exist. That doesn't mean there's not still problems. For instance, all of those colonial states still exist with their problematic borders. And there's a real fear of trying to adjust those borders. If we look at Africa, we've only seen a couple really major attempts to resolve some of those European kerfuffles that were started by colonialism, like the emergence of South Sudan and Eritrea. Why? Well, ultimately it comes down to there's a fear that if we let the rabbit out of the hat, then it's going to start, things could just go very bad very quickly, and it could actually lead to a period of extended war all over the African continent as different states contend over what is their proper border. So basically an attempt has been to try and sit on those old borders. Whether that ends up being the right decision in the long run, I couldn't begin to tell you. All right, standing armies will be gradually abolished altogether. Guys, that just hasn't happened. There is a general sense that there should be arms limitations, however. And certainly a lot of the most dangerous weapons of mass destruction, there's a constant active effort to limit those armaments. But armies, maybe not as much. Okay. 4, no national debt shall be contracted in connection with the external affairs of the state. In other words, specifically with the intent of creating a justification for conflicts or evasion. I think we can say 50-50. States still use debts as ways of manipulating each other, but they don't really use it so much as a basis for warfare anymore. So I'm going to call that a so-so. It's the right direction, but maybe not quite enough. No state shall forcibly interfere in the constitution and government of another state. Certainly that's a rule of thumb for international affairs, and also it's one that gets violated constantly. So luckily, most of the time it's through intelligence services, but still it's sometimes done with outright military processes. So it can be quite nasty. So I'm gonna give that a big X. We haven't gotten there yet. No state at war with another shall permit acts of hostility which would make mutual confidence impossible. So basically, human rights violations. And I think we've made huge progress on that. We've made progress all the way back with the Geneva Conventions, with the Chemical Wars Conventions, with all the various tons of conventions about how we're going to fight war, are literally aimed at exactly that. That doesn't mean that war is good or ethical or that we always live up to those conventions, but we've made massive progress as a species towards trying to live up to those. So that's something. I'll take that all day long. I said that kind of like Porky Pig. Okay. All right, so that leaves us just with our definitive articles. The civil constitution of every state shall be republican. Well, certainly, not every country is a democratic republic today, right? Or a republic in any real sense. But there has been a steady, consistent progress since the 1970s towards republicans. Now, for the first time in human history, the majority of people live under a democratic republican government. They live largely in rule-of-law states that are free and fair in their government. That doesn't mean they're perfect. Some of them have really big problems. Some of them have medium-sized problems, and some of them are doing just peachy keen, you know? But But the general trend, especially since, say, 1974, has been for increasingly the number of states under durable, free rule of law regimes has been steadily increasing. So that's nice. That's very good. All right. The Federation of Republics one. There we go. The right of nations shall be based on a federation of free states. Obviously, there's been an explosion. There was some after World War I, there was an attempt to create some intergovernmental organizations. There were a couple before them, like the Postal Union and so forth. But it's really after World War II that we see the intergovernmental organization kind of come into its own. The League of Nations had failed, and that failure is seen by a lot of the world as part of the reason World War II had happened. And so what has it come down to? Well, ultimately, we see the emergence not just of the United Nations, but a whole array of intergovernmental organizations. And here's the thing, guys. They seem to have a very real effect on the frequency of war. If we look at Europe, for instance, Europe isn't just in the system of IGOs like the United Nations, but it also has the European Union. And you're like, well, Dr. Smith, who cares? Whatever. I'll tell you what. Europe had been arguably the most violent place in the world in terms of intergovernmental, interstate war, basically, for, say, I don't know, 1,000 years. Only the Middle East and Europe really were in competition. And I would say that for most of history, Europe just blew that out of the water when it comes to interstate warfare frequency. World War II comes about. We have the rise of the intergovernmental organization. Boom. There's only been one really significant war, the Balkan Wars, following the breakup of Yugoslavia in Europe since. And that's not insignificant, I don't think. I don't think that's a meaningless thing. Now, that also, it's easy to poke a hole in that, it should be said. You could argue that's because of American hegemony, coupled with Franco-German and British co-hegemony on the continent. And I think that's also reasonable, too. You could argue it's because of the emergence of thermonuclear weapons. You could argue it was because the Cold War emerged, and just surviving that was far more important than Europeans fighting each other. All these are reasonable assumptions. So it's too early to say, that absolutely worked. But it's certainly true to say that we live in the golden age of the international federation, as Mr. Kant would call it, the intergovernmental organization. And then finally, the third definitive article, cosmopolitan rights should be based or should be limited to conditions of universal hospitality. Well, what we do see is actually that there is a clear universal recognition of certain rights, ambassadorial rights, diplomatic rights, military rights, and so forth, that most organized governments do a pretty darn good job of, not all, but most, of actually recognizing most of the time. Most of the time. Tourism, shipwreck victims, you name it. It's not universal, but it's not bad. We do have all sorts of statements on universal human rights, which are much, much broader than Kant's vision of like simple humanitarian kinds of basic rights of hospitality. Those are frankly less lived up to. Now, why would Kant want a more narrow or restrictive definition on what constitute universal individual rights? Probably to make it less likely that states had a justification for invading each other and interfering in each other's constitutions. That's my guess. Anyways, guys, this has been a long one. I didn't even think it would be very long at all. So I'm going to give my voice a rest and tell you all adieu. Call me if you have problems. Email me. We can set up an appointment to talk about anything. And take care of yourselves. Be safe. And that's it. I'll talk to you later. Dr. Smith says goodbye.